Okay, so good morning, everybody. We're going to get started. Feel free to keep on going for the coffee, Rugelach, all the other good stuff that we have back there. So we're halfway done with the course. I just wanted to summarize a few where we've been and where we're going, because it's going to move to a totally different arena. There's no source sheet today, but you have a blank piece of paper in case you wish to jot. The most important things that we've covered in the first four sessions go something along the lines of, we try to define as precisely as we can while keeping it somewhat loose just what has to be part of Judaism, which includes belief in God, belief in the revelation of the Torah and prophecy, commitment to the oral law as well as halakha, rabbinic authority. We believe in a personal God, one who has an interaction with us on some form or another, and we also believe in the messianic future. Those are basic tenets of Jewish faith and thought. And once one goes beyond that, then one is no longer believing in traditional Jewish thought. As we've discussed back in the day, there are debates about how precisely to define which boundaries, the nature of where dogma fits into all of this, but at least that we had going for us is part one. Part two was then discussion of how we relate to people who don't personally choose to believe in or observe everything, right? Which was a second component. You know, the rule is Judaism remains the same. But people, it's a personal commitment, and especially in our day and age when many Jews either are not sure about what beliefs are or have questions, or they don't observe 100% or even necessarily 20%, what do we actually do in practice, which is a separate question from what is Judaism, right? So that was the second week. Then the third week we spoke about areas of philosophy, Kabbalah, Jewish experience, different things that invigorate observance, that Judaism never just thought that laws are some rote mechanical thing that we have to do because God said so, but rather it's all about the personal experience and different ways of creating color in our experience. Then last time we discussed Rambam and his desire to make sure that Judaism was fully in sync with science and reason as he understood it. And even though his 12th century mode of thought is significantly outdated in many ways, we talked about the principle, which is very important. And in terms of creating Jewish unity, that until this very day, there are always debates within people who believe in the Torah, within people who are committed to the Torah, how one should or must understand 6 days of creation and evolution and all these science questions, and just how reasonable the Torah needs to be. And we spoke about how there are always going to be debates, and there are always going to be hostile debates, actually. The way to create Jewish unity is to appreciate that the playing field within those who are committed to belief in the Torah is vast, and to allow for disagreement while taking away the venom. In other words, as long as we're not calling each other really horrible things, we can agree to disagree, and that's a more productive mode within tradition of how to deal with incredibly different viewpoints on these subjects. That's what we've... They disagreed and disagreed strongly. So it's, well, a little less extreme on average, but there certainly was a lot of venom. Okay, that was because there was a war going on. That's not a matter of belief. That was something completely different from what we're talking about. That was politics. That was politics. Politics is different. And so here we're dealing with just people who are not at war with somebody and how they relate to different beliefs. That's where we've been so far. Now suddenly we have to move to the 20th century. Because when you have 8 weeks, that's what you do. You talk about the ancient principles, you talk about the medieval major debates, and then you move on into the 20th, 21st century. And we start talking about modernity is really complicated because everything is different. As much as we have age-old Torah and age-old halakha and age-old beliefs and age-old principles of how to deal with everything, everything about our world is absolutely and entirely different. And suddenly, rabbis and thinkers and scholars had to deal with this on a much more fundamental way than ever before. The last 200 years have thrown us for a loop. Here are some things that are different, and I'm sure that I'm missing some of the big ones, but here are some of the really big ones. One,
there's hot water for tea.
Hot water for tea. Okay. Again, feel free to get the tea and come back, and you could even brew it midway. Oh, so very good. One of the most important differences is that we suddenly have been integrated in most societies into our dominant culture countries. That changed everything, because all of a sudden Jews had to develop strategies. For all those years, we had our own autonomous community where we pretty much ran separately. Nobody wanted to marry us, and we didn't want to marry them. We were often persecuted and certainly suffered a lot of discrimination. All terrible things. But that also meant that Judaism could kind of remain in a certain bubble. What happens when suddenly the world is saying, we want you to enter our society, but we want you to be like us? It's incredibly unwelcoming, but when so-called enlightenment, which is very so-called and very unenlightened, but so-called enlightenment changed the game, or because so many people believed in it. Even though you're right, Voltaire, father of the Enlightenment, was a vicious anti-Semite and was thoroughly, like so many other so-called enlightened people, obsessed with Jews, and negatively so. And all the great philosophers who were so enlightened and brought much good to the world, they really had a lot of great ideas. Many of them also were obsessed with Jews, and usually negatively. So your point is very well taken in terms of practicality, and I don't ignore that at all. But in terms of the theory, many Jews had to struggle with what's our best strategy for integration. Right? Some Jews said, let's not integrate at all. But that was the minority. Some said, let's try to figure out a way of being fully faithful to traditional Judaism while embracing modernity. Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in Germany was a diehard traditionalist in every sense. He really believed in enlightenment. He saw this as an unbelievable good for the Jews. You know, there are some goods, at least in theory, getting out of the ghetto, the promise of non-persecution, the promise of human rights sounded very appealing. Even though a lot of it fell, to put it mildly, very short of what those ideals were. So your point is very well taken in terms of what really happened and what happens. There's still tons and tons of Jew hatred in the world. Tons. And even in so-called enlightened nations.
And even that ghetto feeling that still persists when you travel to South America or Europe.
To some degree, Jews always retained communities, and that's good. We like having communities. I think that we wouldn't survive without them. But all the same, many of these communities are still integrated into the broader culture, to a little or to a major degree, right? Okay, good. Ongoing water issues, but everything is under control. In the meantime, that's one major thing that changed, and with it came, within one century, in 1800, in 1800, ballpark 90% of German Jews kept Shabbat. In 1900, ballpark 10% of German Jews kept Shabbat. In just one century, most Jews opted out of the most basic elements of observance, let alone the minutiae. Just talking about the most important things, which have always been hallmarks of what Judaism is, suddenly we're not there anymore. That was one component, but this had much more to do with assimilation and accommodation to the broader culture. And there's no question that that had an enormous impact. The first generation chose to stop, but their grandchildren just grew up with that, right? In other words, grandchildren didn't choose in any particular thing. They simply grew up with a different thing. Suddenly, traditional rabbis realized that traditionalists are in the minority of Judaism. In the olden days, the Talmud talks about a Shabbat violator as an idolater. One who violates Shabbat publicly has distanced him or herself from the community of Israel. And we view them as though they're idolaters, right? That's the way the Talmud describes it. Well, what do we do now when 90% of Jews are violating Shabbat? And they don't even necessarily, and they're not doing it to rebel against Judaism for the most part, right? For the most part, they might break Shabbat, but they don't say, okay, I don't want to be part of the Jewish people. They want to be part of the Jewish people. They have very strong identities. They're committed to the community. It's different. That's a pretty big reality change. Here's another big reality change, the founding of the State of Israel. Right? There's just nothing in our sources for such basic things as a democratically elected government. In the good old days, in the biblical period, we had kings. Okay, none of us wanted to go back to monarchy, thank God. What do we do with a democratically elected government? What do we do with the fact that women want to run for office? You know, we have the judge Deborah, who everybody makes a big deal about in our literature, but she was anomalous in the biblical period. What do we do in terms of a real democracy? Where the best people should run, and at least the people who are most liked by more people are the ones who get elected. How do we do that? The changing roles of women and the changing concept of family have been overwhelming, right? And every single aspect of all of that is a moving target and has changed so radically in the last 200 and certainly in the last 100 years. Well, we need to think about what do we do with halakha, all of our traditional concepts, what do we do in terms of modernity, right? Technology, the scientific developments in terms of just fertility treatment alone, right? But just all the electricity, that's a pretty big one, and all of the things that come with that. How do you deal with new realities? And then here's a big thing which we hadn't thought about much. Suddenly we have a chance to talk to other people and share our ideas with them. This light unto the nations idea, which we made such a big deal about back when in the prophetic era, we didn't really get a chance to be such a light. Not because we were doing anything wrong, but because nobody was listening to us. Suddenly, for the first time, we can interact with a broader society and bring our values out there. Right? How do we do it? Or are we capable of doing it? Are we able to see ourselves as a world religion rather than just a ghettoized, localized, communal religion which takes care of Jews and we take care of ourselves? And we're not even thinking about what do we have to say to other people about every major issue under the sun. We never had to think about this stuff, at least not seriously, for 2,000 years and sometimes even longer. Well, what does Judaism do? What does tradition do with the fact that we have an utterly new reality? It's not a slightly new reality. Everything, all the basic things that make up our community are different. And so that's what the next four sessions are about, dealing with radical change, sociological change on every level, and it affects us on the most basic levels. What does Judaism do? So, of course, the ultimate authority on all these questions is my father. And he's written, I mean, the lion's share of his writings over the last 45 years plus have been on facets of that issue. He's not the only one who deals with it. Many other great scholars, rabbis have dealt with these issues. And we're going to be dealing with just the premise of what Judaism must be. One thing that my father has written about called Modern Orthodoxy and Halakha is that some people have the misconception that we have to freeze Judaism in some particular time. You know, for Hasidim, it's 18th century Poland. You just freeze there. It's not really frozen at all. Hasidic life is often very much more vibrant than the external stereotypes. But some people have this idea that Judaism, in order to be traditional, has to freeze itself in time. The first people to ever do that were the Karaites. They really did freeze themselves in time. They said the biblical period is it, and we need to live biblically. But Rabbinic Judaism rejected the entire premise. The whole point of Rabbinic Judaism is that Judaism must apply to all people in all times. There's no such thing as, oh no, here's something new. Judaism has nothing to say. And that's one of the most important premises of Judaism. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik considered that one of the tenets of Jewish faith, to believe that all Judaism must always apply to all Jews of all times in all places. There's no such thing as anything else. Huh? Yes. Okay, fine. Sacrifice is a very different model. Right now we don't have a temple, so the way we apply it is we don't bring them, right? So.
But it still applies.
Right.
So what you said, meaning it applies in the way that we don't bring them.
Right. So we always have something. We always have something to say. So two of the greatest rabbinic thinkers of the previous century were Rabbi Ben Sion Uziel and Rabbi Chaim David Halevi. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik also belongs in that camp, as does Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook, and many others as well. The difference between Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik is that, and the other two, Rav Uziel and Rav Chaim David Halevi, is that Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik have made it. Everybody quotes them. They're widely studied, scholars are all over them, they're taught in yeshivot, which is good, they should be. They're two of the great visionaries of the 20th century. The mistake of most yeshivot is that they almost entirely ignore Rav Uziel and Rav Chaim David Halevi. And one of the most important points, which anybody who understands how complex this world is needs to realize, is that we need to have as many traditional voices in the mix as possible. Not because everyone is always right or always going to make it or always be accepted, but we need to have different strategies and different solutions to different problems. If we don't, well, then we don't have enough solutions to our problems. I was in Hillcrest a couple of weeks ago as a scholar in residence and gave a talk on Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Halevi. that's a very hefty reason why that is the case. And so I just got up there in Hillcrest and gave a whole talk on Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Halevi, and I said, I don't care who's Sephardic, who's Ashkenazic, it doesn't matter. Here are two great Jewish thinkers, just like Rabbi Cook and Rabbi Soloveitchik are two great Jewish thinkers. Sephardim should read them too. In other words, I don't think that just Ashkenazim should read Rabbi Cook and Rabbi Soloveitchik. I don't think just Sephardim should read Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Halevi. Huh? Right, so some of this had its merits and some of this was a problem. So the point of this line of scholarship, which again, my father has written extensively about, probably more than anybody, at least in English. I think we could rest assured that in English, nobody's written more about these two figures. In Hebrew, there's a growing concern in Israeli scholarship for them because they realize there's a growing sense, hey, here are two great visionaries who have a different point of view. We got to get this point of view out there. Just for discourse, and that's how I presented it in Hillcrest. I said, I don't care who I'm speaking to. Everybody needs to hear this vision, and then we could decide what's the most appropriate strategy to be able to use all of them. So Rabbi Uziel was born in 1880 in Jerusalem, actually. He was part of the old Yeshuv. He spoke Arabic. And he remembered the good old days when Jews and Arabs, at least more, got along. It's not that everything was always harmonious, but there was a lot more getting along in the old Yeshuv, just because if nothing else, there were fewer people. It wasn't that sort of society. It was just a much looser and calmer place for the most part. At some point, he became the chief rabbi of Salonika, which was a tremendously important Jewish community until Hitler exterminated them in World War II. But Salonika was really one of the great bastions of Torah scholarship and observance throughout the entire Jewish world pre-World War II. And then he came back and became the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and eventually became appointed as the chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel. Well, it wasn't Israel yet. He was appointed as the Rishon Lezion, the chief Sephardic rabbi of the Israel community in 1939, and remained in that post through the founding of the State of Israel until his death in 1953. That's Rabbi Uziel's quick, background nutshell. He was part of a group of incredibly visionary rabbis who understood very, very well, A, 20th century is different from everything we've ever seen before, and B, Israel is different from anything we've ever seen before. It's not just another country where Jews live. We have to think about every major issue that nobody has thought about. In other words, what do? We always go back to the early literature and read what rabbinic precedents there are. What do you do when there just are no real precedents? Well, then you got to comb everything, have complete command of the sources, and try to figure out how to apply them. One thing that Rabbi Uziel felt the need to mention, just because we Jews were so not used to this, he said, Judaism is a world religion. And he stressed this time and again. He said, the prophets always say we're supposed to be a light unto the nations. He then points out, correctly, we were never given a chance. If we're living in ghettos or excluded from communities or facing intense discrimination, nobody wanted to hear what we had to say, so we stopped even thinking about what we have to tell them. He said very often, Jews simply don't realize we have a message to other people too. You know, one of the great champions of that in general in the world today is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He understands only too well that Judaism is a great world religion, and that very often it has a vision that's useful not only for us, we're all the converted, but it has a vision that's useful for everybody, just in terms of the complex 21st century reality that we live in. Torah has something to say to it. And that's why I'm such a huge fan of Rabbi Sacks. Yeah, Phyllis? Right, so your point is very well taken. I mean, in general, Jews have never, or at least, I shouldn't say never, but at least for the last 2,000 years, historically, we haven't been in the business of trying to convert other people to Judaism. We've not been in that business. In the olden days, we might have been, at least more so, or at least more Jews were into that idea back in the pagan world. Since Christianity and Islam basically imposed death on any of us who tried that, that got off of our agenda in a very big way. We just stopped, right? So what we're talking about here is not proselytization. We're not talking about trying to get people to become Jews if they're not already Jewish. We want Jews to be better Jews, but we have a vision that's good for humanity, right? In fact, the Bible single-handedly is the most influential book, or collection of books really, on world history, right? Or at least arguably so. I imagine it probably really, really, really is. And that's because we have a vision to everybody. Now, sometimes that vision gets watered down or distorted. That's why you need people like Rabbi Sacks in the front line saying, here's what we really stand for. So your point is extremely well taken, Rita.
I wonder whether we've sort of accomplished that, because it seems to me that the world holds Israel to a different and higher standard than other countries. We hold ourselves to that, but the world is judging Israel in a way it's not judging other countries. And I don't know, it could be only anti-Semitism, but it could be you are the people who believe in democracy, who believe in civil rights, and you're not doing it to the Palestinians. And, I mean, murder is going on everywhere else, but Israel's the only place that they say that.
Right. Without getting into the whole political backdrop to all of this, there's no question that at least a lot of this is motivated by serious Jew hatred.
Right.
But part of it also does come from, besides just the traditional Jew hatred morphed into an Israel context, which everybody talks about, there's also this, you know, backdrop of challenging the religion of Judaism. I think that you're right. In other words, one of the things that Rabbi Cook argued for very strongly, by the way, is that he said Jews have to be faithful to the Torah for a totally different reason for what every other rabbi would say. He said, of course, Jews should be faithful to the Torah. But he said, in Israel, Jews need to be more faithful than ever. He held us to a very high standard, because he said that the Balfour Declaration was predicated on, this is the land of the Bible for the Jews. And if Jews aren't being faithful to their Bible, it undermines the political side of it. In other words, besides the traditionalist reason of Jews should be faithful to the Torah, period, he said that on political grounds, the world gave the land of Israel to the people of Israel because of the biblical claim. But if Jews themselves don't care about the Torah, or at least a lot of Jews don't seem to demonstrate the values of the Torah, there's a hazard in that. So again, I still think at the end of the day, there's a lot more anti-Semitism than this idealism. But Rabbi Cook said there's a real concern from that point of view. George?
Two things. The last comment just triggered a thought that it's interesting that when the Chinese communists took over and they went to all the minorities, they went to the Jews, the people who represented themselves as Jews. And part of the reason they were never officially recognized as a legal minority within communist China was that they weren't observant. They worshiped their ancestors. They didn't have any of the customs, traditions, and rituals that the Jews had done. My question is a little different, and may not be the context today, but it's something to bear in mind, and I think merits discussion at some point throughout the last couple of weeks, which is that many people, many Jews, have taken a secular life or a revolutionary life or a socialist life, looking at it, it's really non-religious is the important point, that they are carrying this idea of enlightening the world and changing things and demonstrating it, representing them as Jewish ideals.
Correct.
And many times, those people who are either conservative or of different religion or just outright Jew haters use that as, you know, it's communists and Jews all the time. But the point is that many of those people sincerely felt and continue to feel that they are carrying forward into the 21st century the ideals of Judaism in a non-religious way, and it's something that one has to come to grips with.
Well, the good news is, not only will I talk about it in the series, that actually is the very next paragraph in my outline. So your timing is very good. Let me respond. Of course. Okay, fine.
So
they also attacked it.
This idea about they weren't given a chance,
the Greeks,
this and that, I'm not so sure that that's the truth.
Okay. Well, for the last 2,000 years, we haven't been given a fair hearing. Going back to George's question, that's what Rabbi Uziel was so adamant about, among other things. He said that anybody who claims to represent Judaism must be representing traditional Judaism. Otherwise, it's a distortion. It might be that people who are not that traditional are adhering to true Jewish values, but a vision that is not committed to Torah and Halakha cannot be called a Jewish vision. Exactly, he was very, very big on that, and correctly. In other words, yes, of course, there are many Jews who even find meaning in certain elements of the Torah. In other words, one of my personal favorite ones, which obviously you don't need to be religious to think this way, the idea that all humans are created in God's image, the very first chapter of the Torah, is a revolution in world history. The idea that we're, according to the Torah, all descendants from the same people, completely rules out any possibility of racism, sexism, all those horrible isms. Right? That's a basic Torah value. And the sages of the Talmud say it just like that. They don't use that terminology, but they're very conscious of the fact that Torah value is that. There's a non-essentialist position that is out there, meaning there's nothing innately superior about Jews. Right? In other words, we have our covenantal relationship with God, but our soul is not different from a non-Jewish soul. Right? What makes us different is our commandments, that God gave us commandments. This is an incredibly open position to the rest of humanity. And of course, going back to George's point, one can be a total atheist and like that value of the Torah and promote it in the broader society, because we need to promote it in the broader society. Sorry that we haven't fixed all those problems yet. But the Torah was...
that thought, but that pronouncement, but many people have different thoughts. That's it.
Many people do have different thoughts, but some of them are right and some of them are wrong. And in this particular case, I'm very pleased that the Torah has an absolute, you know, an absolutely democratic principle that underlies all humanity, right? So that's point number one. Rabbi Uziel was very emphatic, though, to call it a Jewish vision, it has to be rooted in Torah, tradition, belief, halakha, or it's not Judaism anymore. In other words, then it's no longer the Jewish vision to the world. There might be other good ideas that are out there. But that's something very different. So how did Rabbi Uziel deal with the fact that most Jews were not committed to Torah, Halakha, belief in the traditional sense? So there's a wonderful story told about him. Right after the founding of the state, where all the rabbis got together and said, you know, a lot of Jews are not keeping Shabbat anymore. We should have a pro-Shabbat rally, which is much better than some other types of rallies where they picket movie theaters or supermarkets or whatever, and it just... I don't know. It doesn't rub me quite the right way. This was just all rabbis getting up and giving pep talks in favor of Shabbat. Thousands of people come, rabbis get up one after the other, all the prestigious rabbis of the country of Israel at the founding of the state get up there and say why Shabbat is wonderful. And of course, Rabbi Uziel, the chief Sephardic rabbi of the new state, gets up and makes a very impassioned plea for all Jews to keep Shabbat. Now back then, there was a fuel shortage in Israel. So fuel was rationed, and the way that cab drivers, the rule was for all cab drivers, is that you had to have a sticker on your windshield saying what day of the week you don't drive. You were only allowed to drive for 6 days a week. You had to take a day off. So in other words, if you took off Shabbat, so you'd have a shin. If you took off Tuesday, you'd have a gimel. All right, so Rabbi Uziel, right after this big Shabbat rally, is followed by all his followers, you know, everybody goes and he hails a cab.
No.
He hails a cab, and I don't know what letter was on it, but it wasn't a shin. Meaning this driver is a Jewish driver who drives on Shabbat. So all of his followers are like, wait a minute, Rabbi Uziel, you just gave this pro-Shabbat speech talking about why all Jews need to keep Shabbat, why this is our life force, and now you're getting into a cab of a Jew who says on his windshield that he drives on Shabbat. He says, what's your problem? I don't excommunicate Jews. And he got in the cab and drove off, right? He said, okay, of course, we all should be keeping Shabbat, but I'm not going to look down on anybody who's not. I'm not going to discriminate against him. I'm not going to humiliate him. I'm not going to not give him business. He's a fellow Jew. That's Rabbi Uziel's balance. In other words, he never for a moment budged from what Judaism is. He understood very well it must be rooted in Torah and tradition. But that doesn't mean that we look to Jews any differently. In other words, we're one people, and he saw that pretty much as well as anybody did. He didn't just see Jews as one people, he saw humanity as one people. In 1921, some Arabs were shooting at Jews in Israel. So the Jews got ready to defend themselves. It was, you know, one of these pre-state skirmishy type of situations. So Rabbi Uziel puts on his rabbinic garb, and he marches onto the battlefield. He tells the Jews to hold their fire. And he just walks right at the Arab side. He was a courageous man. And so they see this rabbi coming at them. They figure they better... And he starts talking to them in Arabic. And he said, we're cousins. What are we shooting at each other for? The land is big enough for both of us. Let's get along. Put down your guns. We don't want to shoot it. We don't want to have these wars. The room is big enough for all of us. And they stopped shooting for that day. In 1939, when he was appointed chief Sephardic rabbi of what became Israel, he got on the radio and he talked about why all Jews need to be united, religious, secular, Sephardic, Ashkenazic, doesn't matter your background, your sociological standing, we're all one people. And after giving that part of his address, he then continues. And he addresses the Arab population of Israel. This was one of his first public address as the chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel. And he said, we reach our hands out to you in peace, pure and trustworthy. We say the land is stretched out before us, and with joined hands we will work it, we will uncover its treasures, and we will live on it as brothers who dwell together. Know and trust that the word of our God will rise forever. Make peace with us, and we will make peace with you. Together, all of us will benefit from the blessing of God on his land. With quiet and peace, with love and fellowship, with goodwill and pure heart, we will find the way of peace. It's amazing that the chief rabbi of Israel can get up there and say that. And he could say it in Arabic. But this was him. This is who he was. He understood not only are we all humanity, but we're, in this case, we're cousins.
Where was the Yemen?
Huh?
Where was the Yemen?
Well, okay, so that's there are some reasons why this vision wasn't, as of yet, fulfilled. And again, one might be skeptical about what the next steps are going to be that's going to change anything. But Rabbi Uziel sincerely believed that this was possible, but he understood that it takes two to tango, right? Sam's point is exactly correct. Here's another thing that people like Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Cook had to think about that Jews had not had to think about, I don't know, maybe even ever, and certainly not in quite some time. Hebrew University wanted to open up a medical school. We didn't have our own Jewish medical schools before. So the question is, at least...
What do you do on Shabbat?
Not only what on Shabbat's the least of our problem. How do you... Are you allowed to do autopsies to learn medicine? What's the problem with doing autopsies? We take the human body as absolutely sacred. Tuma is for Kohanim. But the human body is sacred. We treat it with the utmost respect. We don't do autopsies. We don't do cremation. We do respectful burial. We do burial right away. Well, if people are donating bodies to science, that means that they're not being buried right away. And that means that even if you dissect them respectfully, you're cutting them up. So are you allowed to do that at all? So the answer should be, I hope so, why? What principle trumps that? To saving a life. You know, it's the whole reason you have medical schools is because these people are not just studying it, but rather they're studying it so that they can go save dozens, hundreds, thousands of lives. You need this medical profession to succeed. But then came the uncomfortable question. Should Israeli medical schools allow Jews to donate their bodies, or should we import non-Jewish bodies? This question came up. Rabbi Cook ruled, again, the first chief Ashkenazic rabbi of what became the state of Israel. He was appointed in 1925. He died in 1935. In other words, he never lived to see the state, even though he was one of the architects of the vision that helped build the state. He was phenomenal. On this issue, he was a mystic. Mystics have a sense, an essentialist sense of Judaism, and that includes a Jewish soul has something different about it. It's hard to define that. So he said all the autopsies should be done on non-Jewish cadavers. That was his ruling. He said Israeli medical schools we cannot allow Jewish bodies to be part of this because there's an extra degree of sanctity. That was his ruling. Rabbi Uziel, who had a great deal of respect for Rabbi Cook, rightly so, said not on this one, no way. He took a non-essentialist point of view. He said, what are you talking about? All people are created in the image of God. Read chapter 1 of Bereshit. There's nothing different about a Jewish body and a non-Jewish body. They're all sacred. They all must be treated in Jewish law with utmost respect. And autopsies in medical school are done with utmost respect for the purpose of saving lives. Then he went further. And he said, not only should one not rule like Rabbi Cook, but one shouldn't even say that. He was ashamed of the position. Right, as much as he had a great deal of respect for Rabbi Cook and continued to have a great deal of respect, as well he should. Rabbi Cook was amazing. But on this particular issue, he said, not only do I rule against him, not only, of course, should we accept Jewish and non-Jewish bodies for medical schools for research, but it's inappropriate to even suggest the other way. Because obviously it sounds horrible, right? You know, the negative PR that comes from this essentialist position that a great rabbi is saying that somehow Jews and non-Jews are different fundamentally is a position that should not even be part of our canon. So he ruled against it. And of course, Israeli medical schools, I don't know that they're always following what the rabbis say, but in practice, of course, Israeli medical schools all follow Rabbi Uziel's position, which is they accept cadavers from whoever donates them to science. There was another... It actually harms science. Right, so on you're raising an even more practical point, which is it harms science. Correct. But even if it didn't harm science, let's imagine we could get exactly, in theory, let's say we could get the same information for from everybody. Rabbi Uziel said it's still wrong. Why? Because it's wrong. Right? So that he was arguing with the principle rather than, okay, the medical school will be compromised if we don't have all available information. And certainly in Israel, you want to know Jewish diseases, and certainly with genetics now, which wasn't the issue in 1931, but it certainly is our issue now. Yes, all the more so. Yeah, Rebecca? Your question is good. I can't give you a metaphysical answer because how do I know how these things work? But I can tell you that the way that traditional Jewish thought reckons with corpses is that since the soul made it holy, it remains holy even after the soul is gone, even after the soul has departed. Whether because the soul is somehow hovering nearby it, whatever that means, or because it's inherently holy, in some sense, because the soul had been in it. So that's why Rabbi Cook felt since a holier soul was there, the body left behind is holier. Rabbi Uziel said that's simply not right. And not only is it not right, but we shouldn't even, I feel bad because here I am quoting the other view against Rabbi Uziel's point to not even quote it. But of course, the point is to understand this fundamental debate.
Did the medical schools ever distinguish between Sephardim and Ashkenazim giving their bodies?
Not on halachic terms, no. But going back to Benjamin's point, though, it might matter for genetically transmitted. Nowadays, things like this actually matter in terms of just good science, in terms of different communities have different genetic strain. At the time, though, not that I know. Another issue that came up, which was a very passionate debate, was can women vote? You know, women's suffrage was a big deal here also. You almost don't imagine that in America also women didn't vote for quite some time, right? Anywhere, right? But I always think of America, of course, in America they always did. No, it was a huge fight over here also. And in Israel it was a huge fight, and Rabbi Cook got on the air. You know, he was very passionate about this point. He said women must not vote and certainly must not hold office. Okay, coming up. He argued that it was immodest.
Yeah, that's like the person.
That was his argument. He said that it's simply immodest. And by the way, on this particular issue, he invoked the Balfour Declaration. He said that we Jews need to be modest. It's not a European value. He said this, whenever he said this in the 1920s, whenever he was making this point. Israel, the Torah is about modesty. It's a core principle and value of the Torah. And this is immodest, and we need to be faithful to the Torah, or else Europe will suddenly back away from its original commitment to us. So he made it a religious argument, as well as blending it into politics, anticipating what Israel was going to look like after the founding of the state, that religion and politics were going to, sometimes messily, get intertwined. Right? Rabbi Uziel said, what are you talking about? Women and men go to work, they go to the marketplace. We don't have a separate society. He would never have even dreamed of the possibility of separate buses. Like, we don't do that.
They stay in the same line when they go to the...
Yeah, that's what Rabbi Uziel said. Not just Kupat Cholim, but when you go to the supermarket or when you go to work, everywhere else men and women interact. So for voting polls, suddenly it's about modesty? If in fact men and women never intermingled, if we really had such a starkly separate society, okay, then the answer would be have separate voting booths.
Do they not now intermingle because the Haredi decision, it's okay, or it's just they haven't gotten there yet?
Now, Haredim want women to vote.
Yeah, but they don't want them to be in the same line. In other words, what you're suggesting, I think, is that there's some things that the Haredim are willing to accept. I would suggest they're not willing to accept it. They just haven't gotten it.
Right, okay, that could very well be, and I'm sure there's some and some and some. But what Rabbi Cook was very passionate about this point, Rabbi Uziel just rejected the claim. He said, we don't live in that world. Our world, thank God, men and women can sit together and learn Torah together, and that's normal, and it's wonderful, and it's great, right? And that's the way it should, and it's not just learning Torah, it's everywhere. So to make a specific distinction, to not allow women to vote for their elected officials who are making laws that women need to obey, is a mistake. And then he went further, and this is actually a very novel ruling for the 1930s.
Rabbi, isn't there an inference even with Adam when he gave him Eve? A helpmate. Well, Eve had a helpmate in Adam. They both had separate tasks.
Indeed.
He worked the field and everything, and she took care of the house. That was it.
They both voted for the same snake. Anyway,
there's an inference.
Anyway,
they voted for the same snake.
Of course, our concept of democracy, where we actually believe, of course, our concept of democracy that all citizens should be able to have a claim and a vote is at least the way we practice it, is pretty new as things go. You're right. So Rabbi Uziel, first of all, said that, of course, women not only should vote, but they're electing officials that are, make laws for them also. And they might vote like their husband, right, if they happen to agree. But if they disagree, that's okay. They should be able to vote for the person they want to vote for. Then the novel part is, he said, and women can be elected. Mm-hmm. The reason why there was rabbinic reluctance to being elected wasn't just about modesty. There's an old principle that women are not supposed to be able to hold authority over men. There are classical sources that say that women are not supposed to be able to hold authority over men, and the term used in halakha is sirara. It's like lording over. Rabbi Uziel said that the prohibition of a woman holding authority over men is only when the men don't want it. No, it's
the men always want it.
Yeah, no, but he said in a democracy, if women are elected, that means that obviously people want them to be leading. So he said the whole concept of sirara does not apply in a community or a society which obviously wants the best leaders available, male or female. This was a landmark ruling. This was not, this might be obvious to us in this room. This was not at all obvious. This was not at all obvious in the 1930s when Rabbi Uziel made this ruling. It was a very important point to say that halakha wants the best qualified people to do it, and democracy obviates, it eliminates the threat of, oh no, unjust holding authority over men. The ancient principle simply would not apply in a democratic society.
What basis did he have for saying that the last 2,000 or however many years were wrong?
He wasn't saying that, but keep going.
No, but what you're saying is he just turned it around, he overruled the rule.
He didn't overrule the rule. Your question is the right one, by the way, and that's what applying halakha to today is all about. Rabbi Uziel brought sources to demonstrate this is what sirara always meant.
Sources that no one else had ever seen.
It was never relevant in the 15th century how many women were running to become the community head. That's why, in other words, that's the point, that modern rabbis have to have mastery of the ancient sources and to understand what do the sources really say and how to apply those sources. He wasn't overruling halakha. No traditionalist rabbi does that. What you do is you have to understand what are the roots of the halakha and what are the most realistic applications to a contemporary world. So that's exactly what his point was. And he brought ancient sources to demonstrate that the concept of sirara, the prohibition of women holding authority over men, is when the men don't want it. But if men want it, this is a Talmudic principle. It's not a 20th century innovation.
What happens if a man dies and leaves a family with a wife? Who takes over? The second command, the helpmate.
There
becomes number
his
one.
His brother.
What law just passed?
It didn't pass yet, but they're debating about it. You know, that saying that Israel is a Jewish state, democracy, Jewish state.
I don't know. The bickering that's going on is based on different formulations of the proposal. And I mean, Israel is a Jewish state, and it's our homeland, right? I'm all in favor of the concept. The debate is over four different recensions and formulations of how to say that so that it's still democratic and simultaneously is the Jewish state. That's what they're debating. So I know that part of it. I don't know the three versions of the proposal so well that I could tell you which one I would have preferred if I were a voter in Israel. I just don't know. But going back to our issue at hand, David's point is exactly the right point, and what Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Halevi, is the star of next week, are all about, which is how do you take, and that's Rabbi Soloveitchik's principle, right, which they follow as well. Any traditionalist rabbi follows this principle that we have to scour ancient sources, ancient principles, understand what are the roots of the principles and how they apply to new society. Okay, so that's how he dealt with women and voting and holding office. One other element which he dealt with on a very fundamental level was the Israeli agricultural establishment. We never had this before, never. We had it in the biblical period. And all of a sudden, there are rabbinic debates over the etrog, you know, that lemon that costs upwards of $75 just because it's got a few bumps on it, right? And it's only, and for a week, and then after that you can get it for $1.39, but you don't care anymore, right? It's all in the timing. So the etrog. There are many rabbinic sources that say that you're not allowed to use an etrog if it was grafted, if the tree was grafted with other species, like a lemon. You have to have a purebred etrog. There are minority opinions that permit grafted etrogim also. So when the agricultural establishment started in Israel, so a lot of Israeli farmers who had etrog groves grafted etrogim. And they wanted to compete with all the other etrog markets in the world. So Rabbi Uziel writes a lengthy responsum where he says, grafted etrogim are permissible, and in fact it's preferable to buy from Israeli farmers than to buy non-grafted etrogim from somebody else. And then he said, look, I know there's nothing in halakha. He said, first of all, there is something in halakha about permitting grafted etrogim, going back to David's point. He's not going to overturn the law, but he's going to follow, in this case, a minority opinion. And he says why he's following it, because he's trying to defend Israeli farmers on the open market. If he doesn't permit it, and if he doesn't encourage it, nobody's going to buy them, and then these guys will go broke. And he followed similar things with regard to their various ways of dealing with the dairy industry. How you produce milk, what types of inoculations you're allowed to give to the cows, all kinds of stuff like that. So Rabbi Uziel, once again, looked at the halakhic principles involved, followed several minority opinions in order to protect the entire Israeli dairy industry. He said, if we don't follow these opinions, there can't be any Israeli dairy industry, or at least not according to halakha. His point was, if we're going to have a state of Israel, it's not just that it has to be a Jewish state, going back to Avi's question. We have to at least have the foundations for how every part of Israel could run according to halakha. Not that everything does. I wish everything would, but right. But the rabbis...
It wasn't a land of honey, it was a land of milk.
That's right. Very, very well said. If halakha were applied properly, halakha and democracy could work together and the state would be running, it would be a Jewish state as a Judaism state, without coercion. In other words, coercion is bad, but it could be run according to halakha.
If David? The principle is that you can do things that you otherwise might not do because of economic sustainability, then wouldn't that apply to movie theaters on Friday night in Jerusalem that require Friday night audience in order to be able to stay open? Or if you remember, we once had a bakery on 72nd that was kosher for a while.
Yeah.
And when he closed on Saturday, he couldn't stay in business anymore.
Right. Halakha is very sensitive to economic sustainability, but you can't break halakha to do it. So I know Rabbi Uziel would say the difference between a movie theater and a cow is that you can't show movies on Friday night, period. In other words, that might not be the right business to go into. The dairy industry, if in fact he had to overturn the law, he would say, I can't overturn the law. Not everything goes to allow the dairy industry to work. But if there are rabbinic opinions one way and the other way, and the only way that the dairy industry could be viable on a national scale is by following opinions, even though there's disagreement, follow the opinions where there's disagreement, right? If there were no opinions to permit, he wouldn't permit it.
You would still have to milk the cow on Shabbat, right?
Correct. There are all these, but in other words, halachists deal with how do you milk cows on Shabbat to prevent them from suffering? In other words, right. there's a whole issue, every single facet of the dairy industry and everything else has been dealt with by the rabbinic establishment, or at least those who realize that there's a difference between dealing with a nation's dairy industry versus, let's say you were a rabbi in a small community in Poland or in Salonika, right, where you might have given a different ruling. That's what Rabbi Uziel's point is. In other words, everybody understands that rabbis disagree. They have to understand what the boundaries are. And everybody is sensitive to economics, but nobody's going to say that for the sake of economics, you could break Shabbat. His argument was, you're not breaking Shabbat, that the law permits certain things, even though there were rabbis who disagreed. Okay, so there's a difference between accepting a minority opinion or a disputed opinion.
Is that really true, though? I mean, if the majority opinion has been accepted as the law, precisely because it's a majority opinion,
right,
for hundreds or thousands of years, suddenly saying the minority opinion is the right one or is the one we should follow. I would submit to you that if that's not doing a 180, I mean, just changing the law.
But it's not. But that, the point of that is not changing the law. In other words, the reason why halakha always
comes... You're saying the minority is
you're
right.
Changing you're what's been done. There's a big difference between those two things. In other words, if he's not, if you're changing the law means everybody says no, and now he's going to say in the 20th century, yes. Right. If rabbis seriously debated this issue in the 15th century, in the 12th century, in the 8th century.
But they concluded the debate, they came to a decision, and for centuries people followed it.
In practice, and by the way, not necessarily, by the way, if there are minority opinions, that means that those rabbis ruled for their community is that you can. Right? In other words, people made real rulings like that. So that's a better way of thinking about it. In other words, in the good old days, individual rabbis made decisions for individual communities. So many ruled one way, some ruled the other way. So Rabbi Uziel has the literature, and he says, if we're going to have a nation that's viable, we need to follow certain guidelines. And by the way, in the 20th century, some rabbis agreed with Rabbi Uziel, and some disagreed. I'm not trying to make a statement for a particular thing. I'm saying that there's a principle that goes on at Rita, and then we're going to have to wind it down.
I was just going to say the example of not teaching girls Torah.
We're going to talk about that one next week,
right.
Yeah.
But then somebody found that there is nothing that says you may not.
David's point is a very, very important point, and we're going to get back to it next week as well and keep on discussing in terms of what the parameters are. And by the way, when it comes to how to apply ancient principles to the modern time, just to give one grand scale example about the viability of Israel, there's something called the Heter Mechira. Right, we are in a Shemitah year, where the chief rabbis of Israel, or at least enough of them, including Rabbi Cook, decided we can sell the entire country of Israel to a non-Jew, just like what we do for Chametz on Pesach, so that way farmers can plow and plant on this every seventh year, right? And many rabbis disagreed with that. They said, what are you talking about? You can't sell the whole land. That's selling your chametz is kind of a farce. But selling a country, as a legal fiction, to allow farmers to just go about their business, so rabbis continue to debate this point, right? So the Rabbi Cooks of the world and the Rabbi Uziels of the world said, we have to be able to make it tolerable for people to go into agriculture. Because this is a nation. It's no longer a rabbi making a ruling for a small town. It's rabbis making rulings for a country. That's the difference. And even within ruling for a country, there are huge debates over these issues. So your point is very well taken in terms of nobody's overturning the law. The question is, how far can you push? Just to give you one other example that has nothing to do with Israel, and then we'll wrap it up. Carrying on Shabbat, right? So the Torah, it's a Torah prohibition. We're not allowed to carry on Shabbat. We're not allowed to go from a private to a public domain, public to a private domain, or even to walk around in a public domain while carrying things. There's a rabbinic concept of an eruv, thank God, right? Which enables us to carry in rabbinic public domain, but not biblical public domain. So that means women pushing, it doesn't have to be women. We daddies like to push strollers too. People pushing strollers, carrying their babies, carrying your keys, is all permissible on Shabbat where there's an Eruv. There is an Eruv here, so you're all in good standing if you've been carrying. But that's a huge rabbinic responsibility. But it relies on remarkable minority opinions, including that a public domain is only defined by if there are 600,000 people on one street, pedestrians at one time. That's not what the biblical definition was, right? But that's how it came to be understood in places like New York and Paris and London, which have Eruvin, because the rabbi said, we have to rely on these opinions because otherwise nobody can leave their home on Shabbat. Mm. Right? That was a huge minority, and that has nothing to do with Israel, but it was a huge, and some rabbis disagreed. It's all part and parcel of how far can one apply these principles in a contemporary society. I just want to read Rabbi Uziel's last will and testament, which he said right before he died in 1953. He said what his goals of life had been. To spread Torah among students, to love the Torah and its mitzvot, to love the land of Israel and its holiness, to love absolutely every Jewish man and woman and the people of Israel in its entirety, to love God, the Lord of Israel, to bring peace among all Jews physically and spiritually, in their words and actions, in their thoughts and in their ruminations of their hearts, in all their steps and deeds, at home and in the street, in the village and in the city, to bring true peace in the house of Israel, to the entire congregation of Israel and all its subdivisions and groupings, between Israel and their Father in heaven. These goals actually are only one. since they stem from one source, namely the Torah of the living God and the King of the universe. It was the King of Israel and its Holy One who gave the true Torah to his people, a Torah all of whose ways are pleasantness and all of whose paths are peace. It's beautiful. That's how he understood the Torah, and his entire life and every single ruling and principle and teaching that he did actually matched that goal. It wasn't just a nice thing to say before you die. It really was everything that he stood for. So his vision, which again, is this was just a tiny taste of that. One other part of his vision, which I'm deferring for 2 weeks from now, is particularly his discussion of conversion to Judaism, which is an important topic in its own right, and we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. Next week, we will do Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi, to be continued. Thank you all for coming, as always, and we'll see you next week.